Hi, this is John Lobel. You can hear my show Visionaries at 10 a.m. on Mondays on PRN. And guess what? PRN now has its own app. So you've always been able to listen to our shows by going to your web browser and putting in PRN.fm. And then you can listen to the current show that's on air. But you can now download onto your smartphone, Android and iPhone, our PRN browser. Search for it in your app store, and you can listen live to whatever.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I'd like to welcome you from all over the world for all the syndicated stations carrying us and the 19 different streaming services. We're here to empower people, looking at the world from a different perspective. We're going to start by giving the latest on health and healing so we can live a longer and healthier and happier life. That benefits everyone. Today also, I'm going to stream here on our Progressive Radio Network Facebook. You can watch it in real time. Two new recipes. And each week I'll be sharing a different vegan recipe. These are recipes that are gluten-free, that are very healthy, and I designed the recipes in order to maximize stimulating a healthy immune system, cleansing and detoxification and rejuvenation. So it's not just tasty, good food. It's not just food that looks beautiful. You can make these dishes yourself. My standard in making a dish is, can the average person with no background in cooking or food presentation, can they make this? And generally about 15 to 20% of the recipes that I create, they can't, so I exclude them. I'll use them privately, but not where it's, you know, for you. What would be the good of putting up a recipe and you can't follow the instructions or make it look, taste the same? So you can. We test these. So you're going to have two recipes. Now, you'll see them, but then you'll be able to download them also and try them. I'd like your feedback. My guest in the second part of our program today is a remarkable mind. In fact, he's a part of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, Professor Paul Craig Roberts. And we're going to deconstruct the lack of honesty and objectivity in viewing Russia and trying to demonize it to the point where it justifies military intervention against Russia by NATO. We'll show you the truth. Did you know that the United States invaded Russia? Yes, we did. Russia has never invaded the United States. We invaded them. I'll discuss that. So we just seem to have a substantial amount of amnesia when it comes to understanding our relationships and how we betrayed all the things we gave Gorbachev. I'll go into that when I interview Paul Craig Roberts on Russia. It'll give you a different perspective. Also today, I'm going to be starting a series on what we should reasonably expect from our government, local, state, and federal. But what happens when the government no longer cares what we expect, but treats us as if somehow we are domestic terrorists, we are a problem, we're to be exploited, we're to collect data from without any input from us? Well, we're past that point. We're in a full-fledged corporatocracy. The only value you and I serve is in how people can exploit us for financial gain or political gain. So we're going to start with one person's view, and then I'm going to ask you to call in and share your view. We'll also share some thoughts by someone who probably wouldn't be invited on any college campus today, certainly would not be able to get his own program on most non-commercial radio, and I doubt on WBAI, and that's George Carlin. Even though it was on BAI that he made the seven deadly words that almost cost Pacifica the license for BAI, but it was a breakthrough. And when you think back at Dick Gregory, who was a friend of mine, close friend of mine, for a long time, 40 years, and you look back at Richard Pryor and Mort Saul and Robin Williams, today they were funny, but they were absolutely crystal clear in what they were mocking or ridiculing. We're going to play George Carlin. And I'd like for you to compare George Carlin to many of the so-called comedians today, because I don't find most of the comedians funny. I don't find any of the late-night comedians funny. They seem to take their time in trying to eviscerate everything on a political level. They use mockery, vulgarity, crassness. Where's their wit? Where is that sharp intellect? The Marx Brothers had it, because they had to get around censors, the Hay Committee. I just don't see it today. So just think of the funniest people, the ones who were Jonathan Winters and others. They could make us all laugh. Where are they today? So we begin. This is a study from Harvard School of Public Health, and it's a good study because it talks about how when we're consuming a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, you lower your risk of breast cancer. Now, anything that can lower the risk of breast cancer and protect a woman's life and health, that's a very positive. And women who eat high amounts, not normal amounts, but high amounts of fruits and vegetables each day can lower the risk of breast cancer, especially aggressive tumors. And those who eat fewer fruits and vegetables, you increase your risk of breast cancer. And this was published in the International Journal of Cancer. Quote, I'll quote from the study, although prior studies have suggested an association, they have been limited in power, particularly for specific fruits and vegetables and aggressive subtypes of breast cancer. But this one showed that you make an enormous difference when you take a lot of fruits and vegetables. That means juicing. Juicing gives you the benefit of 100% assimilation, meaning everything that was in that carrot or pear, once it's juiced, 100% that's going to go into your body. You're going to get 100% benefit. Whereas if you eat a fruit or you eat a carrot, probably if you ate a carrot, 15% would actually get into your bloodstream. The rest would be going out of the body as lignocellulose, meaning the fiber's too hard for your stomach acids, hydrochloric acid, to break down. So if you want maximum nutritional benefit, juice. Now, you should do both, of course, and that's important. And also, it talks about they're averaging 5 servings. Well, I think that an average serving per day should be 12 servings of fruits and vegetables for optimal health. Now, this is from the University of Illinois, and it's published in the Journal of Medical Chemistry, and it says that the omega-3 metabolites show anti-cancer effect. That means when you have a hand of walnuts and you consume them, or you have a teaspoon of flaxseed oil, or hemp oil, or avocado oil, or sesame oil, or if you are not vegan and you want to have it from cod liver oil, all of those are good sources of the omega-3 fatty acids. That lowers your risk of cancer. Now, we know that it lowered your risk of heart attack and stroke and lowered your blood pressure and helped turn off inflammation in your brain and the laying down of the amyloid beta plaque. And when you have all those little streaks of plaque in the brain, it interferes with normal neuronal activity and circulation. So chelating out all that plaque from your brain is no different than chelating out the plaque from your arteries and the walls of your arteries. It allows better blood flow. And the more blood flow to the microcirculatory system in your brain, the longer your brain is going to stay healthy and active, the less likelihood you are to have Alzheimer's, dementia, and other conditions. So this is good. And they looked at osteosarcomas, which is a bone cancer, and the omega-3 was able to lower it. Also, there's an interesting study from the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health published in Thrombosis and Vascular Biology. And what it says is that in postmenopausal women, don't think that because you have a good HDL, high-density lipoprotein, that that's automatically protecting you from heart disease. Because historically, there's very low-density lipoprotein, low-density lipoprotein, and high-density lipoprotein. The first two are negative, meaning when you have an elevated LDL, that's bad. But when you have an elevated HDL, that's good. But no longer can we say that. So don't look at your HDL. Look at your total cholesterol. That's far more meaningful for you. And garlic, onions, shallots each day in the diet, either eat them ideally lightly sauteed, because when they're lightly sauteed, all of the sulfur elements are at their most potent and they're most likely to engage in chelation. Chelation. Just visualize that you have a toxin and you have a chelating agent like chlorophyll. This is good for people with brain problems also. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis. You have a chelating agent. Chelation comes from chele, meaning claw-like. And in comes this chelating agent and envelops the antigen or whatever you're trying to get rid of and takes out of the blood and takes through the liver and decomposes it, conjugates it, and gets it out. So every time you have a glass of celery juice, any greens, kale, Swiss chard, collard greens, watercress, that's terrific for chelation. But the superstars, those that take the whole effort up tremendously, chlorophyll in liquid form from wheatgrass juice, chlorella, which is a seaweed, and spirulina, which are also seaweeds. Vitamin C, quercetin are two of the best supplemental chelators. In fact, I've been able to help people take plaques out of their arteries by using just that. And you have to do it about 3 or 4 times a day. It takes longer, but it's really beneficial. So get your vegetables, get your juices on a daily basis. And for those of you who've seen the ads about having whiter teeth, well, if you don't smoke and you don't drink wine, your teeth will generally stay much, much brighter. The trouble is people today want perfect teeth. So you see all these people taking normal teeth, having them removed, and putting in bridge work teeth. And I see more commercials for that now than ever before. But what they're not telling you is that these whitening agents are almost always bleaching the enamel off your teeth. That's not good. You don't want to destroy your enamel. If you suck on a lemon, that's not good. That much acid in your mouth can erode the teeth. That's why anytime you have anything that's acidic, including orange juice, grapefruit juice, lime juice, lemon juice, always rinse your mouth out afterwards or brush your teeth. It'll protect your mouth. Then you still get the benefit of everything that's good for you. Well, there's now something that's been discovered, published in the ACS Biomaterial Science and Engineering, and it brightens your smile, but does not, I repeat, does not adversely affect or erode your enamel. And it's a team-modified titanium dioxide nanoparticles with a polydopamine nanoparticles, so they could be activated with blue light. And so this is a very easy, inexpensive process to whiten your teeth without hurting your enamel. You'll start to see it in dental offices in the near future. Also, chamomile tea. Now, when I first got involved in the health movement, chamomile tea was the tea. It was a calming tea. Chamomile is a wonderful tea, but it has a lot of health benefits you may not be aware of. And according to the latest research that I'm looking at right now, chamomile tea fights depression and anxiety. It prevents digestive disorder, so it's good if you have heartburn or other problems or GERD. It also helps combat cancer. This was interesting. Quote, in an animal study published in the Journal of the Federation of American Society of Experimental Biology, researchers credited apigenin with remarkable anti-proliferative effects against various malignant cell lines. Well, apigenin, A-P-I-G-E-N-I-N, that's important in stopping this proliferation. It's anti-inflammatory. It reduces oxidative stress. And it is anti-diabetic. It's antibacterial. It's inexpensive, easy to take. So take yourself some chamomile each day, and that will help. And also from University of Helsinki, the Finnish soldier impingement control trial compared surgical treatments of shoulder impingement syndrome to placebo surgery. 2 years after the procedure, the study participants, both those in the group who underwent surgery and those who did not, had the same outcome. So if you're spending a lot of money and you're undergoing this procedure, think again about it. And that's important that we not have unnecessary procedures. And finally, from King's College, which is in London, they want to know what is the impact of depression on the developing fetus. This is so important because think of all the women who may be depressed for various reasons, not realizing that their emotional state is creating a biochemical reaction in the developing fetus to pre-program them to be susceptible to depression. Quote, the physiological impacts of depression on pregnant mothers may affect babies while in the womb and lead to changes in the behavior and biology of newborns. In this study, babies born to mothers who were depressed during pregnancy showed altered behavior soon after birth compared to babies from healthier mothers who didn't. Now, we also know something that's rather remarkable, and that is that a person's thoughts early in life or traumatic experiences actually changes the structure of the brain. This is part of the epigenetics. Epi meaning larger, environment we're in, workplace, home environment, relationships, and our genes. So everyone and everything, either constructively or destructively, impact our body and our genes. So that's why, friends, try to select the people in your life who are positive, upbeat, and not cloying, not manipulative, not emotional sponges, not drama people, because you pay a price. That's the latest on health and healing. And I mentioned yesterday that I would mention this on this judge allowing electric shock in a school. But before I get to this, this is the University of Illinois. Now, we all know that green space is very important. Being around plants and flowers and trees and nature helps us heal. So being in nature helps restore your brain's ability to focus attention on a task. But if you're checking social media on your phone or answering emails on your laptop, even if you're doing so while surrounded by trees, your brain is not getting the benefits that nature confers. Quote, the space conveys no benefits if your head is in your device. Professor William Sullivan, professor and head of the University of Illinois Landscape Architectural Department. Now, how many times have you seen people in nature, their heads down, they're texting, then they're not They shouldn't be there. Recently, I had a photograph I posted on my Facebook showing a museum packed with young people, not one looking at a painting. They were all looking at their devices. Last evening, I went for a walk, and I walked into a restaurant. It was packed, a vegan restaurant. Young people mainly go there. Not a single person was talking with each other. I was just amazed. I did not have a camera. I don't, in respect for my time, I never take cell phones when I go out. Because if I'm out walking, there are times when I just love to walk. Like I walked down to Lincoln Center last night and walked around, and I was interested in what was playing, some really good art films playing, and an off-Broadway play at Lincoln Center on My Fair Lady. And I'm thinking, wow, now I can enjoy New York culture again, which I miss when I'm on the road. And every single person in this restaurant, young person, was not engaged. Everything was on their social media. I'm thinking, look at what you're losing. The ability to have real companionship, interesting conversations, enjoying a person's company. So they're not going to pay attention to the food. They're not going to pay attention to the conversation. They're going to pay attention to social media. So this is saying same thing works in nature. And finally, this is from John Vibes of the Natural Blue, Natural Blaze. This is from Bristol County, Maine, and it says, Family Court Judge Catherine Filed denied a motion to stop the use of electric shock on disabled students, a form of punishment that has been controversial for years after news of the practice first reached the public in 2013, when video surfaced of an 18-year-old student receiving dozens of shocks for refusing to take off his jacket. Quote, the state failed to demonstrate that there is now a professional consensus that the level 3 aversion treatment used on this person does not conform to the accepted standard of care for treating individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, end quote. Yeah, no, we can raise the bar. All right? Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world who are just joining us. You can watch this program. And by the way, I want to thank the thousands of people who've watched it in real time. And tomorrow for our sister station, I'm playing my Progressive Commentary Hour. It is a powerful discussion of how the media and the government manipulates our thoughts, controls our thoughts and actions to their advantage and our disadvantage. One guest, one theme, really phenomenal show. And I'm playing this on our sister stations because many of the people don't have internet. So it's just as a public service to them. On PRN regularly tomorrow, I'll have my regular show. Now, I have an article here from Common Dreams from students for a national health program, and their solidarity with medical students who demand single payer now. This is an open letter. So what I'm going to do is this. Tomorrow on PRN.fm, I'm going to read this, their open letter, but then they don't have solutions. I have the solutions. So for those of you in this audience, like myself, who want single payer and get profits out of medicine, I'm going to show you in the details how we can deconstruct our existing for-profit model and replace it with one that will actually save money. Won't cost us money based upon what I've found in the existing system. And we will save hundreds of billions of dollars. I have it all worked out. The figures are accurate. I'm using the government's and actuaries' own figures. So this isn't supposition. So to the student for a national health program, listen in tomorrow or download the show at your convenience, and all the solutions anyone needs for single-payer health care is there. Now, let's go to a person who is one of the leading debaters at Oxford in their debate series, Brendan O'Neill. Now, he's a firebrand. On some things I agree, some things I absolutely disagree with him. But he's a true intellect, and he's not afraid to share ideas. And I don't look, do I have to agree 100% with someone, because I rarely do. But that doesn't mean someone may not have a piece. And here's my point. In life, if we exclude people because there's something about them politically or ideologically or their religious views that we disagree with, we simply slam the door on everything. That's extremely closed-minded. I have found that in life, you take each piece of this puzzle of life as you come across it and leave what you don't like, leave it be, and then work with that piece in your own inimitable way. That's what we're going to do with Brendan.
Nudging, the nudge state, which in my mind is even worse than the nanny state because it's so cynical and secretive, this idea that the powers that be should nudge us in the right direction, should nudge us towards good health, should nudge us to make the right decisions about how we pay our taxes. Even the right the way in which men aim at urinals is now become a part of the nudge state, where in urinals across Europe, they now have little flies, pretend flies, so that you will urinate on them and not spill. And this is part of nudge policy, seriously. This is part of the actual nudge policy to nudge us towards good behaviour because we're all such animals. And it completely circumvents public democratic discussion and just assumes there's a right way to behave, and the only role of us lot is to be nudged in that direction. So, it's annoying, it's grating, it's illiberal, it's killjoyish, all those things are absolutely true. But it's not enough to say that. I think there's a far more profound problem, which all of this crap represents a reversal of the Enlightenment itself. The birth of the modern democratic era is being undone by these people, by the nanny state, by the nudging state, by the new bureaucratic authoritarian elites that run the Western world. And if you had to sum up the Enlightenment, I would say the whole message of the Enlightenment was that we have to restrict the government's authority over individuals, over both our bodies and our minds. Both our bodies and our minds should be free from external intervention. That's the Enlightenment, summed up in one sentence. Every single serious document and tract and thesis of the Enlightenment had that message at its heart. And it's not surprising that the Enlightenment comes after the Inquisition, because the Inquisition represents possibly history's most shocking intervention into people's souls, into their minds, into what they thought, into what they believed. Nothing was private. Everything was open to policing and punishment. You could be burnt at the stake for what was in your mind. So after that calamity, that historical calamity, comes a new idea, an Enlightenment, that people should be free to think what they want and actually to behave pretty much how they want. So one of the first expressions of this new idea came from Edward Coke, who was this great English jurist who basically brought the Magna Carta into the modern world, one of my heroes. He said, "No man shall be tried upon his secret opinion." This was the post-Inquisition message. No one should be tried or punished for his secret opinion, for what he thinks, what's in his mind. It was a revolutionary idea in the 1600s when he said it. And today, again, when you have Barry Spurr being sacked from the University of Sydney for his secret opinion, for what's in his mind, for what he says to his friends in private, it has become, once again, a revolutionary idea to say that no man should be tried or punished upon his secret opinion. Then later on, you have John Locke, his letter on toleration in 1689, which is basically the founding document of the modern Enlightenment. That whole letter is about, in Locke's words, settling the bounds that lie between the business of government and that of freedom of thought. He basically wanted to stipulate that you have individuals over here and you have the government over here, and they should leave us alone. He said the government should only be concerned with outward things, the structure of society, the collection of taxes, various other things like that, but never with inward things, by which he meant our beliefs, our thoughts, even our bodily integrity. There's a really interesting line in Locke's Letter on Toleration where he says, if a man is making himself ill, should a doctor have the right to intervene? And Locke says no, because we have to take individual sovereignty so seriously that people should even be free to make themselves sick. And then we move on to Kant, another one of my heroes, Kant, and his essay, What is Enlightenment? If you read What is Enlightenment now, it's hilarious, because it is basically an argument against the nanny state. It's basically Kant arguing in the 1700s against the nanny state. And Kant complains about the fact that he says, I have a book that thinks for me, a pastor who acts as my conscience, a physician who prescribes my diet. He goes on and on about these nannying people who want to run his life and tell him what to think. And he calls them guardians. And he says, these guardians treat us as domestic cattle. And he says, they carefully prevent us from taking a single step without the leading strings to which they have fastened us. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because it is echoes brilliantly the kind of system that we live under today. We may not have pastors who think for us anymore, but we certainly have experts thinking for us, parenting experts telling us how to parent, anti-smoking experts telling us how much we should smoke. The same kind of phenomenon exists, the same guardians exist, they just express themselves in a different way. Kant could have been writing about Australia in 2015. It's really worth rereading his essay. And then these ideas are taken even further by John Stuart Mill, who then sums them up brilliantly when he says, the individual should be sovereign over himself. And that's his very famous line, the individual should be sovereign over himself, but there's a little clause in there which sometimes gets left out, which he says, the individual should be sovereign over himself, over his own body and mind. So what you have here is a real articulation of the idea that both our thoughts, our minds, should be free from external interference, and so should our bodies. So should our own person, the fact that we should be able to do to ourselves what we want. And famously, Mill said that it's only when you harm another person, not when you harm yourself, only when you harm another person that the state should have the right to interfere with you. So that is an extremely potted history of Enlightenment thinking, but the same argument comes through, right through Coke to Locke to Kant to Mill, which is this idea that the individual should be sovereign over himself. And I think what we have today is a complete reversal of that on so many different levels. And for me, the thing that summed this up best is not just the drinking stuff and the smoking stuff and all those irritating rules and regulations, but the comments made by the Nudge Unit in Downing Street. Downing Street now has, inside Downing Street, there is something called a Nudge Unit, which is devoted to changing citizens' behaviour. You know, in the old days, citizens would elect a government and then the government had to do what the citizens wanted it to do. Now, in a complete reversal, the government does what tells citizens what it thinks they should do. And this Nudge Unit says that it wants to be the surrogate willpower of the people of Britain. It wants to be our surrogate willpower. And what that means, it wants to think on our behalf and act on our behalf and carve us into the kind of moral, physical, healthy creatures that it thinks we should be. And that takes even further the phenomenon that Kant was talking about, these guardians who are constantly breathing down our necks, telling us how to think, telling us how to behave. It takes it to another level. And I think, so what we're seeing is not simply the rise of petty, annoying rules and regulations, but the reversal of a whole historical epoch. But this kind of 300, 400-year idea that the individual should be sovereign and that the authority should be restrained from interfering in our lives, that is being undermined by the rise of...
Now, I'm one of those people who believe that the government should not tell me what to think. I'm a vegan. Never once in my life have I encouraged or demeaned or in any way used my belief in veganism as a standard for my friends. Dr. Martin Feldman, all my friends, bright people, nice people, good people, but they eat meat. So I'm not there to proselytize. I'm not there to condemn. I'm there to share their friendship. I'm not here to convince people to change your way of life. I'm here merely as an example to share information and insight, and then I stop. There's a boundary, and I must stop and respect your right and your freedom to choose or reject whatever information or examples that you wish. But what if you were demanded that there's only a certain diet you could have? What if you were told that there's only certain medicines you could have? Even if other medicines were shown to work better, but and you were taking a medicine that was never shown to cure anyone or actually to harm, and it mandated it. So right now, that nanny state is mandating, and they're extremely good in the media of mandating what is acceptable or unacceptable behavior towards Syria and Libya. Right now, I posted just yesterday a photograph of three African men tied by their ankles, upside down, hanging in Libya in a square, and they were amongst hundreds that day being sold in slavery. I didn't see a single comment upon that anywhere in the media. That's because we've been conditioned by that nanny state, the media, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, not to make the suffering of others due to the consequences of our actions significant. We see young boys locked in a cave and facing death, and it grips the whole world's attention till they're rescued. At the same time, during that same period, over 10,000 children in Libya died of starvation. Not a single word. So we have concern for those kids and no concern for others that we're directly impacting. That's the power of the media. That's the power of telling people what they should think. And now on top of that, robotics don't think. They're machines. But artificial intelligence does think. And now there's new artificial intelligence, as we speak, that can read your thoughts, anticipate your actions. There's a whole nanotechnology to put nanoparticulate matter that's been programmed into your brain that can take every single memory you've ever had and record it so it's visualized. That's how advanced it is. And transhumanism is already in advanced stages, where everything is to collect data on you. Do you realize that every single thing you do, everything you purchase, every food you eat, everything that it can be electronically tracked, every one of your new computers, every one of your new televisions, take your finger across the top and you'll feel a little indentation. That's a camera watching you. Did you ask for that? Do you care? They're listening to everything. Do you care? It's in the contract. So they're programming people to be good citizens. But wasn't not Thoreau who said you cannot be a both good person and a good citizen? Choose which? He chose to be a good person, not a good citizen. I don't want to be a good citizen if it means conforming to mindless masses who are subjugating every ethical, intellectual, creative, and spiritual and moral decision to the state. The state be damned. Our entire political system is corrupt. Beginning to end. That's why I'm asking people to walk away from it and become independent. From your independence, then take your time and see what piece of the puzzle makes sense to incorporate in and what to leave out. And that's important. Professor Paul Craig Roberts, he is one of today's most progressive political and economic writers and commentators on the state of the nation and the government dysfunction and political corruption and global and domestic economic threats and the war on terror and Wall Street. He's an expert on all these, and he was the chairman of the Institute for Political Economy and a former Assistant Secretary of Treasury during Reagan's first term. And during his academic career, he has taught at many universities, Tulane, Stanford, George Mason, and he held the William Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic International Studies at Georgetown University. He's authored many books, including The Neoconservative Threat to World Order, Washington's Perilous War of Hegemony. Paul, it's good to have you back.
Yes, I'm glad to be with you again, Gary.
Paul, I'm concerned, and if you had an opportunity to hear any of our previous commentary, that through the Age of Enlightenment, from Locke and Hume and others, we were encouraged not to surrender the sanctity of our individual being to some collective political or ideological groupthink. And many people were punished for their independence of thought. And yet today, the mainstream media, both left and right, are trying to conform our thoughts to their political ideological truths. And they start by demonizing Russia and Putin. And now every word out of every Democrat and Republican's mouth is Russia. Russia interfered, or they didn't interfere, or they interfered all the time. And at no point does the people involved step back and take an honest look and say, who invaded Russia? The United States did, France did, England did, Belgium did, Germany did, after the First World War in 1918 under Woodrow Wilson, signed a decree, and all these countries that fought in the First World War went back into Russia to try to steal its assets and destroy the Bolsheviks. And America stayed there till 2020. And that's never discussed. It's not discussed that we betrayed Gorbachev. Clinton did, specifically Hillary and Bill Clinton. She's the dominant. We know who's on top in that relationship, intellectually and politically and ideologically. She is. And Gorbachev signed the accords to dissolve the Soviet Union, providing that there would be an era of peace. And yet, it was Baker, who was Secretary of State, says, we promise you that the Warsaw alignments, NATO will go one inch eastward. And then under Clinton, everything you could do to expand NATO went up against Russia. None of this is being discussed. None of it. That Russia does not represent a real or existential threat to the survival or safety of the United States. And therefore, they're posturing and positioning him like they did Gaddafi, like they did Assad, and like they did Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Lies and conditioning. Your thoughts?
Well, Gary, the budget of the U.S. military security complex is $1,000 billion annually. Now, that is a huge sum. It's larger than the gross domestic product of all but a handful of countries on the face of the earth. And it's funded by American taxpayers at a time when they have many unmet needs. And so a budget this vast has to have a reason. And so they have manufactured a reason, and that is the dangerous enemy, Russia. So Russia has moved into the position that the Soviet Union was in during the Cold War, except now it's even heightened in terms of the accusations and orchestrated threat level. So that's the justification for the military security complex's budget. And along comes Donald Trump, and he says, I'm going to normalize relations with Russia. That is, I'm going to take away the enemy. Oh, no, you're not, Buster. You're not taking $1,000 billion a year away from us. We're far more powerful than you are. Even President Eisenhower recognized that more than a half a century ago. How much more powerful do you think we've become since then? We own the press. We own both political parties because nobody can campaign against us and expect to be reelected. We even own much of the highly concentrated American media, and we pay the rest of them to print what we hand them. In fact, the CIA openly brags about it, and the German newspaper editor Udo Ufkati wrote an entire book proving it. And so Trump is faced with an all-out attack, both political parties, the entirety of the print and TV media and NPR, The military security complex is sitting there pulling all the strings. And what did Trump do? He did exactly what every American president has always had a responsibility to do, dating back to the end of the Second World War, and that is to reduce dangerous tensions with the other major nuclear power. Every president did that. Kennedy did it. Nixon did it. Carter did it. Reagan did it. It all came to an end in the Clinton years, as you said. So since Clinton, we have been building up these tensions, and Obama brought them to the highest state when he organized the American coup that overthrew the elected government in Ukraine. So here's Trump. I'm going to normalize these relations, and the military security complex says, no, you're not. So he goes to Russia, as he should do, to get these dangerous tensions reduced, and he's accused of treason, high treason, openly participating against America with America's enemy. Just look at the headlines, New York Times, the Washington Post, wherever. Anderson Cooper, all of these people who are on the take from the military security complex and have been. And so we see what we are experiencing right now, Gary, is sedition at the highest levels as the military security complex unfolds its coup against the elected president of the United States. They're accusing him of treason, of openly conspiring with Russia against America. These are unheard of accusations against an American president, and they're everywhere. So I think what we're witnessing here is a coup that is unfolding. What can Trump do? Who can he count on? He can't count on the Democrat Party. He can't even count on the Republican Party. He can't count on his own government, certainly not on the Secret Service, nor the Pentagon, certainly not the media. What can he count on? Where is his support? And there's no complaint against these accusations that the president of the United States is a traitor because he wants to make peace with a nuclear power. Every president wanted to reduce the tensions.
We
have to be realistic. Now, an unaware person might think, oh, this is silly, and laugh, of course, and not. But it's not silly. It's unfolding right before our eyes. President Trump has been set up as a treasonous enemy of America. You hear it 24/7. The very fact that he met with Putin proves, according to the media and the Democratic Party, and for that matter, the Republican Party, that he's in league with Putin. And if you just look, they show you this everywhere. For example, have you seen the cover of Time magazine? There's Putin's photo, there's Trump's, and they merge into the same person so that you get a composite of Trump and Putin. This is Time magazine. In other words, they're the same person. In other words, it's just as the media proclaims, Trump is Putin's lackey. He is conspiring against America with the number one enemy of America. Now, this is a call for removal from office. It could very easily lead to his assassination. And nobody is noticing or saying, this is not normal. This has never before happened in our history. And there's total silence.
All right, Paul, I appreciate that overview. To our satellite stations, we are going to extend the program for another 5 minutes because I have some important questions I'd like to have our guest state. Tell us your view of Putin. I've done research on Putin's background. It's interesting. He is a he, at the very least, he is an extremely intelligent person, but also you have to look at like what Russia was like prior to Putin when it was under Yeltsin and totally controlled by the oligarchs in the United States, and then what it was like, the poverty level in 1992, which was over 44%, because all their benefits were taken away from them, free education, free medical care, housing, all that was swept away, no more pensions. And what it is today and why the younger educated people, the professional class, and is supporting Putin, what he's done for the country. Not a word is said about what Russia's like today. They called it a bankrupt country, the most deplorable country around the world today. Well, clearly these people haven't been there and spoken with the average Russian. Would you give us your view of what's actually happening today in Russia and why Russia does not represent a nuclear threat to the United States or invading the United States or any of the Eastern allies like Germany? And they had recently had Russia would invade Germany and anyone else that wanted to.
Well, Putin believes in the rule of law. He believes in diplomacy, not threat and violence. And Putin was a protege of Yeltsin, and so the United States was not concerned when Yeltsin's protege became the president of Russia, because the United States had completely and totally controlled Yeltsin, as you said, and we were looting the hell out of Russia. And Putin quietly put a halt to that while during that period under the George W. Bush administration, when the American neoconservatives were preoccupied with all of their wars in the Middle East. They weren't paying attention, despite their doctrine that their principal goal was to prevent the rise of Russia or any other country that could serve as a constraint on American unilateralism. All of their plans in the Middle East went so badly wrong. You may remember the Iraq War was supposed to be a three-week cakewalk. You may remember that. It went on for years and years and years. Afghanistan is still going on, 17 years war. All of these things blew up in their faces, and they were preoccupied and didn't notice that Putin had quietly restored the Russian economy and had quietly restored the Russian military. And they didn't really notice this until they paid attention to his remarks at the Munich Security Conference, in which he said that Russia had its own interests and was not and was independent of American will, and no longer would subordinate Russian interests to the United States. And he came down pretty hard on the United States for disrespecting the sovereignty of other countries and that sort of thing. And everybody, that is, all the neoconservatives, all of a sudden said, oh my God, look, somebody has come along that can get in our way. And sure enough, he later proved that in Syria, when he blocked the Obama regime's plans to invade Syria. And he proved it again in Iran when he blocked the Obama regime's plans to bomb Iran. And then he demonstrated it again when he went into Syria and defeated the American organized, financed, and supported terrorists that were serving as our proxy to overthrow Assad. So he's shown that Russia is capable of standing up to the United States, and that the United States is no longer a unipower, and that the United States no longer can exercise hegemony over the world. And the people in Washington are furious. They are furious.
Well, I appreciate
the military security complex sees this as a way to forever protect the massive budget it has, for which there's no need, for which the American people do without all kinds of things, so that the enormous profits roll into the handful of the armaments.
I appreciate you sharing your insights with us. Apologize to the stations for running a little over. You've been listening to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, one of the most in-tuned and aware scholars in the world on these issues. He said it. He is accurate. You're not going to hear positive, honest, or objective information from any of the media, right or left, because the neocons control both. And as a result, we're being programmed to accept that if NATO decides to invade Russia, it's a good thing. No, it's not. And we'll be here to continue to challenge their narrative. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.